fast an hour goes up here. When I was a student, it always went very slow. Anyway, we're going to talk about William Boyd today and his, I think, extraordinarily amusing but also very revealing portrait of the 20th century through the life of one man, Logan Mountstuart. Whether you love Logan or hate Logan, and I assume you do both, as I do, it is really well worth reading if you haven't managed to read it yet. I'm not so naive that I think you've all read it in advance. I haven't got many PowerPoint pictures, but I don't think you're going to need it. You can use your imagination. William Boyd might well have written Any Human Heart for this course, since we need to illustrate a number of approaches as we talk about biography, autobiography, memoir, and I think his book illustrates each of these in turn. It is really essentially the form about the human heart, and I think that quotation which I attributed at the beginning to Henry James, never say you know the last word about any human heart, is the key to what Boyd himself is looking for in his examination of Logan Mountstuart's life. The autobiographical is particularly evident in this Boyd's ninth novel. He freely accepts that personal experience, often unconsciously, affects a writer's fiction. And there are lots of similarities with Boyd's own life, better than telling you what he did and when he was born, isn't it? We'll do it through Logan Mountstuart. Logan Mountstuart, narrator of the journals which form the body of the work, is like Boyd of Scottish origin, and not born in Britain, but in South America, Logan. Boyd himself was born in Africa, and some of you may know his book, A Good Man in Africa, or Brazzaville Beach. I think a delightful writer. He was born in Ghana. Half a century apart, Boyd was born in 1952 and Logan Mountstuart in 1906. And of course, one of the points of the book is that his life covers more or less the 20th century, Logan's. And so 1906 to 1992 or 3 is something that will enable Boyd, as he goes, to touch on the main events of the history of that century. Very simple but very effective idea. Both author and subject go to a small public school, which he makes suitably horrible, Gordonston in the case of Boyd, and an invented one called Abbeyhurst in the case of Logan. Both are at Jesus College, Oxford. Logan as an undergraduate and William Boyd as someone who went on afterwards to do a PhD there. He also taught in Oxford, and if you think he's a bit hard on Virginia Woolf, as he comes across her in the novel, it's because he said he got awfully tired of teaching seminars on to the lighthouse to keen young ladies at St. Hilda's College, Oxford. Both men know France well. Boyd's first university was the University of Nice, and his French is obviously very good, and they also know Spain and New York, as well as Africa and Scotland, settings which I think Boyd uses brilliantly to bring out certain themes in the book, and which he does with great conviction because he actually knows the places he's talking about. In 1948, for example, when the still grieving Logan, remember his wife and daughter, the wife he really loved, and really thought he'd come home to, were killed in an air raid, and he comes back from being a prisoner of war, and he sees that they're not there. But he's still grieving in 1948, and he goes to Paris to meet his great friend from school, Ben Leeping. And the condition of Paris post-war perfectly mirrors the condition of Logan's own heart. It's not on your sheet, this, I'll just read it. Back to days and nights of walking through my favorite Paris quartier, a flâneur and a noctambule once again. On the surface, Paris looks unchanged, as beautiful and as transporting as it always has been, untouched by whatever went on during the war. But there were food shortages, and darker currents flow beneath the surface. Everyone, not a communist, seems terrified by the communists. A jangly, hysterical atmosphere. That, of course, is how he himself is feeling. As Giles Fodden remarks in his Guardian review of Any Human Heart, from his 1981 debut, A Good Man in Africa, onwards, Boyd seems constantly to have been searching for a unifying identity across different fictions, trying to make sense of a life comprising a brutal public school education, Africa in wartime, Oxford, literary London, and New York glamour. All of those feature in the book. So when all is said and done, the heart the novel tries to dissect is the author's own. The biographical element, on the other hand, is equally strong, according to Boyd, who confesses that he is fascinated by the life and work of that generation of English writers who were born at the beginning of the 20th century and reached maturity by World War II. That is, of course, for those of you who are not British, but even for those of you who are, perhaps you need reminding, no, you don't, 1939. People like, and this is still Boyd, people like, and you'll recognize some of them, or Evelyn Waugh, Graham Greene, Anthony Powell, or Powell, obviously, but also less well-known writers, Henry Green, Lawrence Durrell, Cyril Connolly, and William Gerhardy. The last two in particular, he says, lurk closely behind Logan. Both of them were brilliant writers in their youth. Both of them have enormous success, and both of them suffer an early demise, as it were, as creative writers, although they go on as critics in the case of Connolly. Logan's fall from favour is equally dramatic, particularly as it's set against his other friend at school, Peter Scabius. I think Peter Scabius, if you know the novel, is one of the better examinations of what success does to a writer. Beautifully done. I don't know whether you've seen the television adaptation of it, played wonderfully by Sam West in that. His sense of self-importance increasing with every good review he gets. By the 1970s, Logan is quite forgotten. He has an early success, but he's quite forgotten as a writer, whereas Peter keeps rising and rising. The only real difference is that he lives on into the 1990s, whereas Connolly and Gerhardy, the two main models for him, do not. They die in the 70s. But of course the purpose is, isn't it, to carry us to the end of the century so that we can see events beyond their deaths that might affect us. Both Connolly and Gerhardy, and I think most of you don't know them, but some of you will, are now virtually forgotten. But both are named in Boyd's novel. And this brings me to another fascinating part of his novel, the fact that he actually uses real and imaginary characters. Slightly disturbingly, actually, I'm very cross with him about his treatment of Virginia Woolf, for example. I feel quite defensive about that. Ernest Hemingway comes in. I'm sure you noticed Hemingway, whose star is at its height when Logan first meets him in Spain and commits suicide in the course of the novel, underlining the theme of the Wheel of Fortune, which of course Boyd's own life and Logan's life illustrate, the rise to the top of the wheel and then the inevitable descent to the bottom. And Hemingway is a tired and disillusioned old man and he commits suicide. By the time he wrote Any Human Heart, Boyd had already composed a fictional memoir about a 20th century, The New Confessions, which is in 1988. If you want another book, I believe that is a very, very good one. And a spoof biography, which I think is great fun because of Orlando, the connection there, a spoof biography which all the critics believed. was about a Tate, an artist called Nat Tate. This was in 1998, and they all said, gosh, we never heard of Nat Tate. Made the critics very cross indeed when they discovered that they had been taken in. Who, incidentally, if you know your book, makes another appearance in Any Human Heart. So he's obviously got a very good playful sense of humour in New York. In Logan Mount Stewart, he tells us he wanted to invent his own exemplary figure who could seem almost as real as the real ones, and whose life followed a similar pattern. Boarding school, well, we've been through this, university, Paris in the 20s, the rise of fascism, post-war, neglect, disillusion, increasing decrepitude, that particularly in the case of Logan, beautifully done, and so on. A long, and these are still Boyd's words, a long, varied, and rackety life that covered most of the century. I actually ended up by liking Logan. I disliked him intensely early on in the book. To add to the realism of his supposed life of Logan, Boyd supplies all the apparatus of a genuine biography, just as Virginia Woolf had done, though for different reasons. But why, you might ask, does he go to such elaborate lengths to convince us that this is a real biography of a real person? And I think partly it's to shape the novel. There's so much material he wants to get in. He wants a very simple shape that will carry him through the material he's going to examine. He wants to say a lot about the 20th century, and Logan's life will enable him to do that while making the reader feel he still knows where he is in the century. And the apparent shapelessness of what one critic refers to as the riotous and disorganized reality of Mount Stewart's 85 years in their extraordinary, tragic, and humorous aspects adds to the sense of realism. I think if he'd painted Logan as all saint or all sinner, maybe we would withdraw our belief, or we would not believe in him quite so well towards the end. It's hard to give shape to a life, isn't it? But it's also hard to give shape to the life of the century. For Logan, Mount Stewart is, in a sense, an everyman. He's not exactly Mr. Average. He goes to private school and he has a private income until his mother wastes it all, his lovely mother, whom he can't really blame. But he's really exploring what Malraux, going back to Montaigne, has called the human condition, la condition humaine. The human condition that each of us suffer. Though Logan is not exactly Mr. Average, he is, as many of us feel to be, and I certainly can say with great conviction I do, a convincingly flawed character. Neither highly idealistic, virtuous, and moral on the one hand, think of his treatment of his first wife, Lottie, nor horribly wicked on the other. He has his faults, but also he has redeeming features. From the start, he believes in compromise, which may be a good or a bad quality, which in a way sums up his whole life. As a schoolboy, walking home from a visit to his schoolmaster, Mr. Holden Dawes, he pronounces him too uncompromising, really, because it seems to me that to be human, you have to be able to compromise. Everybody would agree with that. Also, from the start, he shows determination, even bloody-mindedness when he wants something badly enough, which could be good, could be bad. Witness his efforts to win the dare or the bet. Do you remember that wonderful occasion when they all set each other a bet at a public school, and one of them has to lose his virginity, which I think he does with great relish, actually. And the other one has to, well, I can't remember what Ben Leaping has to do, but certainly Logan has to get into the first 11, the first 15 rugby team. Something which is as unlikely as they can imagine. And he does so quite happily, by lying about his father's health. Oh, well, you know, my father is dying, and I have to get in because it would make him so happy, so, and a couple of quid to go with it, and they let him in. But, of course, the irony is that the father really is dying. And Logan has no hesitation in using things for his own ends. His two sides, but you see, although he lies about his father's health, he also loves his father very dearly. And as I say, when his mother loses his money that he should inherit, he forgives her. He is capable of love. He is a man who appreciates what they have done for him. There is a very sad scene, and this is number one on your sheets, which you now have, which shows him to be capable of great sensitivity and caring with his father. This is a scene in the Austrian spa where his father has gone in a vain attempt to regain his health. I asked him from time to time how he was feeling, and his replies never varied. Absolutely tip-top. Right as rain, my mood kept surging from ineffable sadness to huge irritation. Sad that his son was obliged to push him about in a fauteuil roulant, that's a wheelchair. Irritated that I should be spending my precious time thus engaged. And yet I can't remain angry with him for long. I was furious with him when we arrived for presenting Frau Dielendorfer with a gift package of Foley's potted meats, corned beef, hams in aspic, and such like. They own a meat packing factory. I said to him, Father, we are not travelling salesmen. There is no need to dispense Foley's products around Europe. Don't be so pretentious, Logan, was all he replied. And I felt very ashamed. I apologised to him later. He has this effect on me. You see that combination? Very, very cleverly done, I think. Mother had told me to take Father out for a good 3 hours. But when we returned to the pension, Mother was away. She's been out all morning, Lucy said. Left immediately after you did. Father was served some soup and then hauled himself up the stairs for a nap. For the first time, an awful foreboding strikes me that he may never be fully well again. And I feel angry at myself for my chronic inability to think more often of others and how they may be feeling. It's a very convincing mixture, isn't it, of nastiness and almost sentience. Logan's two sides combine when, in order to comfort his dying father, he lies to him about his intention of taking on the meat packing factory, the last thing he is ever going to do. But Logan generally tries to be honest, especially in his diary, however unattractive it may seem, and it does at times seem very unattractive. After lunch at Oxford, for example, with Peter Scabius, who is at Balliol College, you know, he's one of the big, famous ones. Logan, poor old Logan, is at Jesus, which is a small, slightly more obscure one. After lunch with Peter, he freely admits that Balliol's Commons, that's the food that they get served to them for lunch and breakfast, are so much better than Jesus's. Three types of cheese, bread and oatmeal biscuits and a jug of beer. I felt strangely depressed for some reason. I think it's because Peter so unreservedly and uncritically loves Oxford and all it holds for him. And I find the place stifling and disappointing. He had also received a letter from Ben, that's the third in their triangle, and I thought jealously, why is Ben writing to Peter and not to me? See how honest that is and how you feel, okay, he's telling me the truth here. Why would he tell it otherwise? He does not deceive himself about how badly he's behaved towards his first wife, Lottie, and reminds himself unflinchingly of the full truth about his marriage to his third wife, Alana, after it is over. This is the second passage. Miss out the first sentence. Alanna and Peterman. That's the new lover she has taken. Alanna and Peterman, it turns out, had been sleeping together for nearly a year when I caught them out. This is the knowledge that really burns, twists the gut. Again and again you go back over that time, charting and logging the lies and duplicities that you missed, acknowledging and realizing that those moments of fun and peace, of happiness, of sex, were feigned and fraudulent, and that the affair was running like a pestilence through your ordinary life, poisoning everything. I read back through these journals, thinking, she was seeing Peterman then and then and then. So much for your fabled power of observation, Aunt Stewart, he says to himself. And then he says, and this again is so interesting, the way we're caught up in this indignation, and suddenly he says, yes, but it's also clear from these pages that I was busy betraying her too. My own lies blinding me to hers. Alanna wasn't so complacent as I was. When I blustered, outraged about her infidelity, she said, say it, Logan. I know you've been fucking jam at seltzer for years. Don't bother preaching to me. Very entertaining, but also very sad. It is Logan's inability to deceive himself that makes him feel so guilty about his failure with his son Lionel by his first marriage, which he tries to rectify when Lionel turns up as a rock musician in New York. It's a very sad episode. But Logan is finally at an art gallery in New York. Lionel tells him that he has finally decided to rename his pop group Dead Souls. You know the book by Gogol, Dead Souls? Mm-hmm. But fails to understand Logan's learned reference to Gogol. And this isn't in your handout. I think it's a tremendous name for a pop group, I said. My words elated him, and he gave a huge, wide smile. And for a poignant instant, I saw myself in him, and not Lottie and the Edgefields. That's Lottie's family. I went weak at the knees, feeling a swarming confusion of emotions. Relief, then awful guilt, terror, and I suppose the atavistic stirrings of an almost love. One of the band members arrived, a sweated and corduroyed youngster with uncombed hair. And the moment was over. Lionel played me some tape recordings of the Dead Souls music, and I made the right appreciative noises. He wants to bring me into his world, to share it with me, and I must make every effort to respond. It's the least I can do. Now, you may feel that's rather awful that he has to make an effort, but of course he doesn't know his son. And yet, as his life progresses, he begins to look back and think, what have I done? How have I failed to love Lionel and nurture him? It's psychologically realistic at every point, this novel. Virginia Woolf asked, as she contemplated the traditional novel form in the 19th century, she said, you know, with the happy marriage at the end, once upon a time at the beginning, and the neat little story in between. I'm exaggerating, of course. She said, as she looked at that novel, she said, is life like this? And of course, what Boyd is trying to do, however much he objects to Virginia Woolf, is trying to make life as it really is, as we experience it, not as we think it should be lived. Logan is also completely honest about his relief at news of what many people consider to be Chamberlain's appeasement of Hitler in September 1938. And there's a long passage about that, which I don't have time to read. But he's also bleakly honest about his own failure in life. And this is extract 4 on your sheet. This is where I begin to love Logan and sympathize. So much easier to love people who are unsuccessful. See, I'm trying to be bleakly honest. I was sitting at the Park Cafe today. So this is 1977 and Logan is now 61. Yes? ancient by his standards, not by mine. I was sitting in the park cafe today having a cup of tea and a penguin biscuit, reading someone's discarded Guardian, when I came across the news of Peter Scabius's knighthood for services to literature. To be candid, I felt a pang of envy before indifference and reality closed in again. It was not so much envy, in fact I've never envied Peter's success. He is too much of a fraud and an egomaniac to provoke real envy. It was more an impromptu insight into my condition vis-a-vis his. I suddenly saw myself in this threadbare, shiny suit with my unironed nylon shirt and greasy tie and my thinning grey hair needing a wash as a truly pathetic figure. Here I was, Here I was, well into my 70s, sitting in this undistinguished, overlit caff, sipping my tea and dunking my penguin biscuit, wondering if I can afford a pint at the Cornwallis, that's a pub, this evening. This was not the image of my elderly self that I had conceived when I was younger. This was not the kind of old age I had imagined I would be living. But then I never saw myself as Peter Scabius' type either. So Logan Mountstuart talked to us today from his lovely home in the Cayman Islands. That was never for me, never. What was for you then, Mountstuart? What fond visions of the future warmed yourself? By this point, Logan has reached what he delightfully calls the dog food years. One of his most attractive characteristics being his well-developed sense of humour. Extract 5. The other day, I wanted to read you so many more extracts, I've been very restrained here. The other day I was studying the contents of what I thought were various tins of stew, looking for one with as many vegetables in it as possible, and thus cut down on my vegetable bill. When I was gastrically taken with the Rubik on one tin. Plump chunklets of rabbit nestling in a dark, rich gravy. I turned the tin round to see that it was Bowser. A tin of dog food on the wrong shelf. But then I thought that if I bought 6 tins of Bowser, chopped up a carrot and an onion, and heated the whole thing in a saucepan, I might have a hearty rabbit stew that would last me a week. I would eat it with my staple diet of rice. Mr. Singh, or Mrs. Singh, buys my rice in 10-kilo sacks from some distant cash and carry. My nutritional and culinary requirements would be thoroughly satisfied, and I would save considerably. So I did just that. And very tasty Bowser rabbit stew turned out to be, especially with the liberal addition of some tomato ketchup and a good jolt of Worcester sauce. So do remember that, won't you? Life reduces you to rabbit. I won't go on. But it's a lovely, that is actually very typical of Stuart, Mount Stuart. Just as you think he's really down, up comes the wit. Often the humour is absurd. Think of Logan's exceedingly short taxi ride after he's had dinner with Peter Scabius in a very, very splendid hotel. Have you ever had that experience? I have. I'm always in peculiar. And, you know, you go out and people say, oh, let me put you in a taxi. And you think, I was going to take the tube home. Get in the taxi. Well, I haven't done this, actually. I haven't got the nerve to do it. But he gets in the taxi and 2 minutes round the corner, he says, oh, I think I'll walk. Logan can be very funny indeed about his failed love affairs, even about his failed encounter with prostitutes. I really, there is one of my favourite passages, but I won't go into it. It's so scurrilous that I'm sure you I was corrupting. And he doesn't hesitate to be promiscuous when it suits him. His marriage to Alana is full of casual encounters with people he meets at art galleries. But he's also capable, and this is why I think of him as a rounded character, he's also capable of complete faithfulness and devoted love when he meets the person he really can fully love, to Freya and their daughter Stella. And we suffer with him when he returns from interment in Switzerland to find that both have died in the war. Even years later, he still weeps copiously when reminded of them. On the other hand, he doesn't suffer fools gladly. Yet when his mother behaves foolishly and loses his inheritance, he instantly forgives her and loves her throughout. He's also a kind and loyal friend, particularly to Ben and Gloria as she lies dying. Gloria is one of Peter Scabius's mistresses, wives, I think. I suppose it's Freudian, but he loves seducing Peter's wives. Two of them, at least. But perhaps Logan's most attractive trait of all, well, I know that's not a terribly attractive trait, is it? I was going to say he's kind and loyal then, but one of his most attractive traits, one which keeps him going to the end, is his enjoyment of simple things. Something that cannot be underestimated, I think, in life. Someone who can sit down and enjoy, as he does, a hot crumpet as a schoolboy, a game of golf on the scrubby African golf course with a colleague that he talks about, to the pleasures of life in France in old age, when he has been left a little house, not very glorious house, but a little house in the middle. It sounds wonderful to me. He says, and this is extract 12, the pleasures of life here are simple. Simple, it just makes me long to be there, I hope it does you. Simple, inexpensive, and democratic. A warm hill of Marmande tomatoes on a roadside vendor's stall, a cold beer on a pavement table at the Café de France, Marie-Thérèse inside making me a sandwich au camembert, munching the knob of a fresh baguette as I wander back from Saint-Sabine, which is the nearest town, the farinaceous smell of the white dust raised by the breeze from the driveway, a cuckoo sounding in the perfectly silent woods beyond the meadows, the huge grey cerise, pink, orange, and washed out blue of a sunset seen from my rear terrace, the shrilling of cicadas at noon, the soft dialing tone of the crickets at dusk slowly gathers, a good book, a hammock, and a cold beaded bottle of Blanc Sec, a rough red wine and steak feet, the cool, dark, shuttered silence of my bedroom. And as I go to sleep, the prospect that all this will be available to me again, unchanged, tomorrow. Beautifully done, isn't it? Long to be in France in the summer. It seems appropriate, therefore, to learn that he is found at his death, as I think I mentioned earlier in the week. It always sticks in my mind. It's that white wine, you know, that comes out. Next to that good bottle of wine, enjoying a book, the plays of Chekhov on his lap. Boyd thickens this simple plot, which follows one man's life in two main ways. By relating his progress through life to the historical events, as I've mentioned, and thus allowing the author to give a biography of sorts of the 20th century. So the First World War, for example, is referred to quite often in the first journal. The rise of Mussolini is also referred to in the 20s and 30s, but indirectly, always indirectly. There's never a kind of solemn examination of a historical event. In the case of Mussolini, he notes in the 1920s when he's meeting Land. Do you remember Land, Fothergill, those of you who read it, with whom he's in love most of his life, actually. And she is much more political than he is. And he's meeting her in a cafe. In an entry from the 1920s, he notes, coffee with Land, Fothergill at the Cadena Cafe. She was wearing a velvet coat that matched her eyes. We talked a little stiffly about Mussolini and Italy, and I was embarrassed to note how much better informed she was than I. So he's just nudging you. Don't forget, this is the period of Mussolini. The general strike of 1926, as it affects him. The Wall Street crash of 1929, as it affects his foolish mother, who has entrusted Mr. Prendergast with her money and has lost it all. The German banks on the verge of collapse. The rise of Mosley and the fascists in the 30s, indirectly again. Anti-Semitism, persecution of the Jews in Germany. The death of the old king and the affair that Edward, and this is one of the, that was, it's one of the best things in the book, the relationship between the Prince of Wales and Mrs. Simpson, whom he doesn't obviously have very much admiration for the king who abdicates in favor of the divorced American woman. The death of King George V then sets in motion this whole business of Wallace and Edward VI, and then he meets them later on, and turns Edward VI into a figure of great, great derision. Edward VI, who is the King of England, sorry. Edward VIII, who is on the golf course, and Logan, who plays golf, is sent out, and is a spy at this point in the Second World War, is sent out to play golf with him and keep an eye on him because he's been a bit difficult to maybe liaison with the Germans, they don't know. And he turns Edward VIII into the most amazing character, who is always catching cigarettes off him. He tries to get, is it his lighter or his matches? Anyway, he gives them up, but he shows him as a figure of fun. The Spanish Civil War, in which he takes an indirect part as a reporter. The war itself, when he's taken prisoner. Munich, preceding it, but then the war following. The Blitz, in which, of course, his wife and daughter die. Pearl Harbor comes in. The assassination of JFK later on in the book. And the landing on the moon and the Nigerian Civil War would be after. I'm sure I've missed out some of those. I just want to give you a flavor, really, of the book so that you would dash back and read it. Logan also takes advantage of modern mass travel in his extensive journeys around the world. Rather than being retold in hindsight, historical events are thus placed in context, seen through what is called the petty lens of everyday living, in the words of one critic. Logan's life as a writer also allows his creator, who manipulates his fictional characters like puppets, to give a literary portrait of the 20th century, and everybody is there. I hope your favorite writers are there. Some are positively viewed, like Chekhov, like Hemingway as an early, in his early manifestation, like Rilke, like Blake, like Shelley. Evelyn Waugh, neutral. James Joyce, neutral. Anthony Poe, Neville Coghill, Virginia and Leonard Woolf. Oh, and so I could go on. So many of these writers are mentioned by him. And, of course, as someone who knows about literature, he's able to give you a delicious little put-down for the ones he doesn't like, and a really encouraging remark about the ones he does, so that you have to go and read them. These real-life people are given invented meetings with Boyd's imaginary creation. Though these encounters are of necessity superficial, however much research went into it, he must have done a huge amount of research for this book. They generally leave an impression of small-mindedness, particularly the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, the Duke of Windsor and Mrs. Simpson, whom Logan is constantly bumping into. Some of the funniest scenes in the book certainly occur there. These encounters also give Boyd a chance to air another side of him, and that is his ability to satirize. He is wickedly satiric. This is not on your handout, partly because it contains such an offensive racist remark in the middle that I've decided to miss it out in the middle, but I want to read you the beginning and the end. That will make you read the book. We dined at Luigi's, he writes, on the 4th of March, 1935, and went to the Café Royal. It was busy, full of unfamiliar faces. Spotted and spoke briefly with Cyril Connolly and Jean, who were with the... and then we can't identify who it was. They left shortly after. Then Adrian Daintree came in. I don't know who he is, but he is a real character. With a party in evening dress, which included Virginia Woolf, smoking a cigar. I let them have our table, and during the general milling around that took place, I introduced Freya to Virginia Woolf. "Are you two here alone?" she said to Freya. "What a ghastly crowd. How it's changed." Totally unconvincing, Miss Oliver. "We were here with Cyril Connolly a moment ago," Freya said, and then the offensive remark about Connolly's American wife. I turned to Freya. "Now you understand Mrs. Wolfe's reputation for charm." Back to Virginia Woolf. "You should be ashamed of yourself." We strode out, and when we reached home, had our first serious row. Freya was a little shocked at Virginia Woolf's fight. I said you would never imagine the person who wrote all that lyrical, breathy prose was steeped in such venom. "At least she writes," Freya said, without thinking, because he's suffering writer's block. But it cut. And so we looked around for something to argue about. And Julie found it. Now I'm writing this, about to go to sleep on the sofa, and I can hear Freya sobbing next door in the bedroom. And then on Wednesday, the 20th of March, to a dull exhibition of collages and photographs at the Nair Gallery, enlivened only by being cut dead by Mrs. Woolf. Positively spun on her heels to avoid me. Clearly, I am not forgiven. Interestingly, while the reviewer John Mullen thought this tactic worked best during the New York Journal years, when he meets all the great names of the day, Jackson Pollock, he doesn't come off very well either, and that invented character, Nat Tate, who was a painter, another critic, Giles Bodden, whom I've already quoted, thought these meetings plausible, but the only false thread occurs in New York, so you must judge for yourself. See how hard I'm trying to get you to read it. In order to help create this realism, it does make it realistic when you meet real people in a book. In order to help create this realism, Boyd has chosen the journal or the diary form, what the French call le journal intime, in which it seems quite natural for Logan to give us his most secret, sometimes shameful thoughts. The French literary journal form, the journals were always published after the writer's death, because they are often so extremely honest that it's rather shocking, particularly about the writer's sexual life. And Boyd, whose first degree was at the University of Nice, follows this pattern, including such delicate subjects in Logan's diary as masturbation, prostitution, and his frank and very different reactions to his three marriages, so that there is a sense that you're getting a full life of someone who has shameful thoughts, good thoughts, bad thoughts, all the way through. Boyd also deliberately misses out periods of Logan's life, which adds to the realism, because, of course, you know, people don't always keep their journals up, do they? I've given up completely, actually, but, you know, there are people who start and then have a bad period and don't write, or have a bad period and do write, and then are happy and don't write. I mean, there are various reasons why people don't go on. There are 9 journals in all, starting at the age of 17 and ending just before his death, age 85. Each one covers a different period of his life and is for the most part geographically identified, emphasizing the importance setting plays in both his life and Boyd's technique. Paris is prominent in the 20s, as indeed it was in cultural life in Europe. Spain in the 30s, as indeed it was because of the Spanish Civil War in the 30s. New York in the 50s and 60s, with that happening New York scene with all the writers and painters. In addition, Boyd says he's deliberately varied the narrator's tone in each to show changes, or rather developments, in his character. So in the first London Journal, he is, in Boyd's words, a modernist aesthete. In the New York Journal, a world-weary cynic. Whereas in the final French Journal, he is someone who found, in Boyd's words, elegiac serenity at last. Boyd says that he wanted the literary tone of each journal to reflect what he considers a major theme in this book. That we change, his words, that we change and grow throughout life. The arrogant, insecure schoolboy and university student become, in his words, a modern young decadent. The bitter realist becomes a drink-soaked cynic, but ends by becoming that sage and serene octogenarian, all Boyd's words already referred to. And I want to read you a little passage, extract 6 on your sheets, which I think shows how this tone of those last years reflects his increasing serenity as he accepts the inevitability of his own death. I booked in here for an initial week. This is on the west coast of France, Mimizan, I think. I booked in here for an initial week, but I've already extended it for another. I sleep well and breakfast late on the terrace. Then I wander about the town, buy a newspaper, and at lunchtime usually make my way up through the dunes to the beach and have a beer and a sandwich at one or other of the beach shacks. Dinner at 8 sharp, chez Yvette, invariably oysters, grilled fish, tarte du jour, and a bottle of wine. The wine could be better. So I asked Yvette if she would mind if I supplied my own. No problem, she said, as long as I didn't object to paying un petit souper. So now I sit in an umbrella's circle of shade on the plank deck of a beach shack, a beer in my hand and a book in my lap. And I look at the people as they come and go and listen to the crash and hiss of the breakers as they curve in, flatten and explode on the sand. I must do this every year while I have the money and the strength. Good for the soul, a few days like this. While the use of the diary form might lead you to expect a certain lack of shapeliness to the plot, since the writer of it cannot, by definition, know how his own life will end, of course, any human heart is in fact very firmly shaped, not just around his character, but around certain and the events of the century, but around several recurring themes of universal appeal. Boyd himself has pointed out the main theme of the book, with which you may or may not agree. The thesis, he says, that we are an anthology, a composite of many selves. The changing self, the multiple self, then becomes one of the main themes of the book. The Logan who mourns for Freya and Stella is not the same self which treated Lottie so carelessly or blindly. The Logan who responds to Ben Leaping, his favourite friend, is not the same Logan who faintly despises Peter Scabius. Another theme is the apparent randomness of life, which Logan reflects on when, for example, he meets Freya by chance in Portugal. He's out there because he has lost his passport, and her father has driven very badly and had an accident and is in hospital, so they meet at the British Embassy. Freya Deverell, I have that feeling of heart race, that blood heat and breath gasp, just writing a name. And there is something aggressive about her beauty. That's Freya from the television adaptation. I'm afraid I can't conjure her up in real life. Something aggressive about her beauty. Her lips are slightly pushed forward. Not so much pouting or making a move, but as if she's on the verge of blurting something out. She's tall and slim, and I would say was in her very early 20s, and very sure of herself, the one so young. Her father, she told me, has broken his leg quite badly, and they think it will be another week before he's out of hospital and fit to travel. I'm getting the steamer to Southampton tomorrow, I said, but can I take you out to dinner tonight? See if I can persuade you to remove me from the Talks Department blacklist. Apparently he'd asked for too much money when they approached him. She's working for the Talks Department. I sit here, and this is really the point of this passage, I sit here writing these words, waiting to go to her hotel to meet her. It terrifies me. The fragility of these moments in our lives. If I hadn't lost my passport, if her father hadn't crashed the car and broken his leg, if she hadn't gone to the consulate at that precise hour, have you ever thought like this?
Yes.
The view ahead is empty and void. Only the view backward shows you how utterly random and chance-driven these vital connections are. You may or may not believe that, of course. Logan's acquisition of the Miro paintings that are given to him by the man he meets in Spain, which helps him to get through the next period of his life, also appears to be cut. Although, of course, his own kindness towards the man probably helped. And both events are linked to Logan's father's philosophy that there is only good luck and bad luck in life. In extract 8, the second paragraph, that's all your life amounts to in the end, the aggregate of all the good luck and the bad luck you experience. Everything is explained by that simple formula. Pot it up, look at the respective piles. There's nothing you can do about it. Nobody shares it out, allocates it to this one or that. It just happens. We must quietly suffer the laws of man's condition, as Montaigne says. The novel treats, too, of the importance of love of various kinds, love for an equal, for a wife or a husband or a lover, the love for children, which he learns slowly, painfully. But most overwhelmingly of all, I think, the curious way in which, as life goes on, whether the lovers stay or go, the theme of aging has to be faced. And something that nobody can deny. In a sense, it's quite a comforting theme, because you see how Logan slowly but surely adjusts himself to that. And it's very amusing at times, too, because he says things that we know are perfectly true. He seems to be aware of it very early on, the age of 32, extract 3, shortly after Stella has been born. I don't know whether you've done this, but I've thought of it. I mean, I've actually thought of it when I look at trees I've planted in the garden. I walked out this evening, he said, after her birth, to the bottom of the garden and smoked a cigarette. Last week, I planted an Acer in the furthest bed from the house in honor of our new baby. The sapling is as tall as me, and by all accounts, it can grow to 40 feet. So in 30 years' time, if we're still here, I can come back and see this tree in its maturity. But the thought depresses me. In 30 years' time, I'll be in my mid-60s, and I realize that these forward projections that you make so unreflectingly in your life are beginning to run out. Suppose I said in 40 years' time, that would be pushing it. 50, I'll probably be gone by then. 60, dead and buried for sure. Thank Christ I didn't plant an oak. He forgets to note the arrival of his 40th birthday, which seems eminently sensible of him, but writes, for the record, as he puts it, on his 41st birthday, that I, who once had a wife, a child, and a perfect family home, now have none of these, and live in a damp and frosty room in my mother's decrepit house. I think he can be very amusing about aging as well. Perhaps that's the bit I find comforting. Perhaps that's all that can be done about aging. Laugh at it. The swift passage of time, the loss of teeth, receding hair, increasing weight, especially around the middle. But underneath, as his passage on renewing passport shows, he is acutely aware and anxious about the inexorable passage of time. On the 3rd of October 1955, he notes, "To the passport office to collect my new passport, valid for another 10 years. In 1965, I'll be 59, and the thought makes me feel faint. What's happened to my life? These 10-year chunks that are doled out to you in passports are a cruel form of memento mori. How many more new passports will I have? One, 1965. Two, 1975. Such a long way off, 1975. Yet your passport life seems all too brief. How long did he live? He managed to renew 6 passports. Another reminder of aging, and I'm running out of time. Boyd includes Isla Logan's annual inventory on his birthday, and perhaps I ought to close with this one. His, of his progress, or lack of it, towards a healthy, sensible life. The equivalent, I suppose, of those pious New Year resolutions which I no longer make. So I know I'm not going to keep. Oh yes, I've got one. I'm going to drink less white wine. And I'm going to read you this, and then I'm going to read the closing poem by Auden, which I think is, for me, sums up this sense of the average man in the street. 58, he says in 1964, that good God, I don't think I'll bother making another of these annual assessments, too depressing. Extract 9. Health fair, no more teeth out, haven't had a Dexedrine for months. Drinking more under control, I ration myself to one cocktail at lunch, but I probably still drink too much in the evening. Smoking, one pack a day, if I don't go out. Somewhat overweight, bit of a belly, hair receding, greying, still recognisable, recognisably the LMS of old, unlike, say, Ben Leaping, now a fat old man, like Gore. Sex life, adequate. Naomi Mitchell, curator at the Museum of Modern Art, my current girlfriend. Respectful, tolerant affair, could be more fun. We date once or twice a week when our schedules permit. Soul, a bit depressed. For some reason, I'm worrying more about my future. I can stay on here in New York indefinitely, running Leaping Feast Gallery for as long as I want, or I'm able. My salary is good, my apartment comfortable, my journalistic output and influence is gratifyingly high. I move in interesting, sophisticated crowds. I travel to Europe whenever I wish. I own a small flat in London, so what are you complaining about, I think? I never really expected my life to be like this, somehow. What happened to those youthful dreams and ambitions? What happened to those vital, fascinating books I was going to write? It's a sobering moment. As I say, I'm only missing one page out, actually. I want to finish by reading Auden's wonderful poem, The Outbreak of War, in which he thinks about the reaction of your average person in the street, which in a sense, Logan Mountstuart is. He's every man. Auden is sitting in a bar in 52nd Street, and he says, he looks at it, faces along the bar cling to their average day. The lights must never go out, the music must always play, all the conventions conspire to make this sport assume the furniture of home, lest we should see where we are, lost in a haunted wood. Children afraid of the night, who have never been happy or good. From the conservative dark into the ethical light, the dense commuters come, repeating their morning vow. I will be true to the wife. I'll concentrate more on my work. And helpless governors wake to resume their compulsory game. Who can release them now? Who can reach the dead? Who can speak for the dumb? All I have is a voice to undo the folded lie, the romantic lie in the brain of the sensual man in the street, and the lie of authority whose buildings grope the sky. There is no such thing as the state. and no one exists alone. Hunger allows no choice to the citizen or the police. We must love one another or die. Defenceless under the night, our world in stupor lies, yet dotted everywhere, ironic points of light flash out wherever the just exchange their messages. May I, composed like them of Eros and of dust, beleaguered by the same negation and despair, show an affirming fame, which is exactly, I would argue, what Logan does in the end. Thank you.